This is Suno India production. You can now listen to all our episodes on our Android and iPhone app. Download it now.
On October 3rd, the Delhi police raided the homes and offices of 46 people, including reporters, columnists and commentators, associated with the news portal NewsClick. All this before arresting its editor-in-chief, Prabir Purkayastha, and the human resources head, Amit Chakravarti, under the stringent anti-terror law, that is Unlawful Activities Prevention Act. The laptops, phones and devices of these people were seized for further examination. The people whose devices were seized not only include people working for NewsClick but also former employees, part-time employees or even those who occasionally wrote a piece or two for the portal. There are accounts of bank accounts examined and rooms upturned. Abhisar Sharma, the news anchor associated with NewsClick, released a video after the raids.
Mere laptop aur mere do phones, jinme se ek phone par main apne karyakram record karta hoon, wo Delhi police ne zabt kar liye. Unhone koi warrant nahi diya. Haan, jo unhone zabti ki thi, to unhone ek letter likha aur usme mere dastakhat karwaye. Magar mera jo saman unhone zabt kiya hai, chahe wo mera laptop ho, चाहे वो मेरा फोन हो, चाहे वो मेरा कैमरा फोन हो, उसको लेकर ना कोई वारंट था, ना कोई खास वजह बताई गई कि भाई ये जब्ती क्यों की जा रही है।
And what is the police looking for? If one examines the FIR copy, there appear to be several pathways to the investigation. Chinese funds, legal aid to Chinese companies, etc. And I don't want to get into it in this podcast. But one significant one is what the police calls false narratives, to supposedly discredit the government's effort during COVID-19. This indicates that writing anything critical of the government policies or action is seen as false narrative. And these so-called narratives can be linked to information in electronic devices. You get my drift? Hello, I'm Menaka Rao and this is the Suno India Show. We as journalists are frankly worried about how our work will be perceived, and it's closely linked to the seizure of our devices, which are used extensively for work. There are no clear guidelines of how seizure of electronic documents can be done. I speak with Prasanna S., an advocate who appears for academics and has filed a public interest litigation seeking guidelines for seizure of electronic documents. So, Prasanna, if you can help me first understand what is allowed in the law for the police to do when it comes to search or seizure to anyone connected in a criminal case.
First, there are a few concepts that I'll try and break down. So, one is that who in the state can come ask for anything from you, right, as a coercive measure. Either to ask you to insist that you produce a paper, a document or a thing, or insist that you cooperate, that they need to come into your home, come into your office or come into your garage, search that place, right? Or then to say that I'm going to confiscate or seize these documents or devices or whatever things, right? So who in the state has this authority, right? So typically police has it. The income tax authorities, the tax authorities have it, whether the income tax or the GST or the Central Board of Indirect Taxes, Customs, Narcotics Control Bureau, CBI, NIA, all of these authorities have powers to search and seize articles and documents. The second is, what is your status? Why is it that the police is interested in you? That they could be interested in you for different reasons. So one, that you have evidence to offer, either as a complainant or a witness, to an offense that they are investigating. Or you are an accused, somebody has accused you of an offense or a crime. Right? These are the reasons why the police may be interested in. Why is this important? Because as an accused, you have different kinds of rights. But if you are merely a witness, there are only certain rights that are available to you under the law. Next is, what are the powers that these police authorities have? Right. So we normally, in common parlance, we discuss raids. People, a bunch of policemen come descend at your doorstep. They want certain things, right? And that could be by means of either a search or a production warrant. Right? A production warrant is under Section 91 of the Criminal Procedure Code, where they say that they specify the documents are the things that they think you are in possession of and ask you to produce it. So in which case you need to reply to it saying that you either have it or not have it and to what extent you have it. The other option is to search if they have a search order or a search warrant. A search under 165 doesn't require a warrant and other searches will require a warrant. So that is a search of a place. So usually your dwelling, your residence or your office, right? So that search is of a place. So they have power to search, rummage through all your belongings and take whatever they want that is relevant to the case that they are investigating. Right? So for the episode now, what is relevant is search and seizure procedures that govern personal digital devices. Why are personal digital devices? We know personal digital devices is not one document or a thing. As I said, Section 91 of the CRPC. CRPC was 1973. In fact, it was largely a copy paste or maybe a little bit of modification of what was there then in 1898. Right? And then it became the 1973 CRPC. So at that time, there was certain specificity where they wanted a document or a thing to be produced. For that, they could issue a Section 91 notice to you. The question now that arises is whether a personal digital device is as specific as a document or a thing. Because a digital device like your mobile phone or your laptop or your tablet is not one document. It has thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of documents in them. It has no specificity, right? In many cases, it encompasses, it diarizes your entirety of at least the recent life, right? Including your most intimate photos, correspondences that you've had with friends, colleagues, and sometimes if you're a journalist, your sources, if you're a lawyer, your clients, if you're a doctor, you're with your patients, right? Or if you're a patient with your doctor, if you're somebody who is in legal trouble with your lawyer, all of this. So all of this communications are there. So therefore, the digital phone is now, or a phone or a digital device is no longer just a document or a thing that is contemplated in Section 91 of the CRPC. So the question now that arises, whether you could even procure a digital device using a production warrant, like under Section 91. That is, all of this question is actually pending before the Supreme Court in a case that we hope that will be heard soon. In fact, I'm acting for the petitioners there. Five academics have moved the Supreme Court in 2021, saying that we need search and seizure guidelines. Because our CRPC, the provisions of search and seizure under CRPC since 1973, right? Even they were upheld in a 1954 judgment earlier, which was later overruled by a 9-judge Supreme Court judgment in Puttaswamy when they tell that the right to privacy was a fundamental right. So therefore, there is a new enlightenment that has been given to us by the Supreme Court in the 2017 judgment of the 9-judge bench, Puttaswamy judgment. So now the practices of the state will have to be modified, or it will have to modify its practices. There has to be, therefore, it needs to evolve new guidelines, SOPs, that govern the search and seizure of digital devices. If you also need to respect the device owner's right, how do we ensure that the authorities don't go beyond what is relevant? Right? What in legal parlance we call it a fishing expedition, where they say that, just, okay, I have all this treasure trove of information, now I'll try and see what I can make a case out of it. That's not how our criminal investigation process. Somebody says there is sufficient material now for the needle of suspicion to point to somebody. So now you go, therefore, there is, now you have reasonable suspicion that there are certain documents that they have. You go procure it. So this is how it cannot be a roving or a phishing inquiry. But what this seizure of devices enables is this kind of a roving and phishing inquiry, because you at one, in one fell swoop, you actually have access to the entire data that is available in somebody's phone.
What is a roving expedition? It's like doing a general population survey rather than following a line of inquiry. As per criminal laws, the police is not allowed to cast such a wide net, and they are supposed to specify what is the document they need. And in case of digital devices, the police has not had to specify this.
Like we were discussing that earlier, you know, if you go to someone's house, you can pick like at most like a room, you can like pick apart a room, but now you just have to pick one device. And that will have all the information that, you know, you may or may not need. But you can just, you know, it was physically, it is very easy to pick something like a device and do this roving expedition, as opposed to, you know, earlier where you had to actually sit and search physically for something. So, you know, that therefore the laws are, as you said, are not as, not adequate.
Correct. So, yeah, so they were the, these laws. The broadly worded search and seizure powers were written at a, in an era that did not contemplate this kind of problem. So when that is the case, it is now important for the courts to step in and issue the necessary guidelines, at least until the time that the state is able to evolve these guidelines, ideally as a legislative measure. Ideally, these guidelines and these safeguards will have to be legislated.
In the PIL, a representative of the Union Home Ministry stated that the constitution obligation is to ensure law and order, and individual rights have to be counterbalanced with larger societal rights as well. The union affidavit also states that state government should be consulted and CBI manual should be considered before making such guidelines. In short, the government does not see a need for such guidelines, at least not right away.
What you said about investigation, I think what's also, I think it would be useful for people who don't understand how criminal justice system works. How is the police supposed to do its work? So, what comes first? Like, it's a chicken and egg situation. Do we get the information and therefore look for that particular evidence, or it's the other way around, where, you know, they search and then find that evidence. So how, like, it's a, it seems like a very fine point, but, you know, maybe if you can explain that.
It is going to depend on the nature of the offense that the police is investigating, right? There are many classes of offenses. I'll give you about four major categories, right? That's in the literature. In fact, that's also before the court. In fact, we put this before the court. One class is where the target of the offense itself is the device. So there is a certain attempt to hack your phone. The device is the target. Then there has to be a certain closer examination of everything in the phone to identify what is the source of the hack. What is the vulnerability that caused this hack to occur? You understand that? So that is one kind of an offense. The second kind of an offense is where the device is the tool or the instrument by which the offense itself is committed. Right? For instance, there is possession of child pornographic material is an offense. Let's assume if that is an offense. So the act of possession is in the device itself. So the instrument itself, the device is the instrument of perpetration of the offense, not mere evidence. The third category is where the contents of the device is evidence of something. For example, your WhatsApp chats being evidence of you having been in a conspiracy to cheat somebody. Your WhatsApp chat, the communication that you've had, lends evidence to whether that has happened or not, whether you've been part of a conspiracy or not. So where that, in that case, the contents of the device is evidence. The fourth category is where it is merely an environment for the offense to occur. For example, if the offense is of defamation, you run a server and somebody has posted the blog and your server hosts it, right? And your servers need to be seized because you need to find out who has published this defamatory information. There is, for that investigation, it's procured. So these four categories were, as I said, so it is the target, the device itself is a target. The device is an instrument. The device is, the contents of the device in the device are evidence for the crime. And for the device itself is merely an environment to the offense. So in each of these, the guidelines will have to be different. The most important, particularly why this is now become important in the cases where all these conspiracy cases where ideally they are looking, the police is interested in the chat and correspondences, where the third category of offenses. That the guidelines will have to be stricter because they are looking at contents, particularly communication. Communication could include, as I said, several other communication, privileged communications, all of that. So the examination of the device for something content that is relevant to the offense, that will need to have much stricter judicial scrutiny as well as in the presence of the accused or the accused's counsel. All right. So that's the guideline that we want. So that the police authorities do not go fishing.
Okay. But what happens to then witnesses? Like say if you look at the Tarun Tejpal case where the victim, who's the witness, she was, her phone contents were examined in great detail to look for evidence of her, you know, like to besmirch her character, etc. Like, so if we leave the accused out of the equation,
right,
if we only look at witnesses
right,
and say like, you know, relatives or family of accused who have, I mean, who directly don't have anything to do with the crime.
Right.
So how do we sort of, because in this particular case, as you know, like we know that a lot of people were searched and, you know, their devices were taken. We don't even know if they're witnesses or accused or not even witnesses. Like they're just...
It's person of interest.
Person of interest. So like, which is a non-category.
Right.
So like how do we sort of, what are the rights of these people?
Right. See, the rights of a complainant, particularly in a sexual assault case, right? Again, we need guidelines. Even this is also before the court. This is also pending before the court, right? The Tehalkar Tarun Tejpal case is an egregious case at that, right? I'm not passing judgment on whether which side is correct, right? But it was a fact that when the Supreme Court gave access to the contents of the survivor's phone to the defense team, it was done without the notice, without the complainant being given even notice of the fact that this is being given, right? Number one. And number two, so the question of whether information that has all been collected by the police, but which they are not relying on for their charge sheet, for proving their charges, whether all of that information needs to be turned in to the defense. This is a question that is at large. This has not been decided. It is not only in the context of digital evidence, but in general, as a question of evidence law, we have judgments this way and that way, right? So whether, particularly in this kind of digital, because we now have the police indiscriminately seizing digital evidence, where all of the information is now with the police, whether giving access to that, all of it to the defense, even when the police is not relying on any of that, right? So that's a question that the courts will have to answer, unfortunately. There are no easy answers one way or another. But yes, so therefore the idea is that particularly when investigating sexual assault cases or cases of that like nature, the police must not take the entire contents of the devices of the complainant. In fact, if the complainant is able to give credibly the communications or the information that she wants to turn in, or she or he wants to turn in, I think that should be the basis of the charge and not anything more.
About searching witnesses and other people who, you know, who may or may not be linked to the case at all. Like, what are their rights?
They have similar rights, except that they don't have a right against self-incrimination. Whether that extends to them when they clearly have been asked only to come as evidence or witness, right? There is no right against self-incrimination. Therefore, they have no right to say, you know, for example, that it's a production warrant. A Section 91 notice is given, for instance. They have no right to say no. Whereas, as an accused, because you have a right to silence, right of silence that extends even to the stage of investigation, right? You, as an accused, you can say no because you have a right against self-incrimination. You cannot be legally compelled to do something when you are an accused person. But when somebody is not formally an accused, in fact, somebody has been specifically called as witness, then they will need to cooperate and produce the articles that are asked to be produced.
But these categories are very blurred before there is a formal FIR. I mean, it's sort of...
Yes. So even when, for example, even when an FIR names as an accused, so there is still a question of whether somebody is formally accused. Actually, the formal accusation does not start until the charge sheet is filed, saying the state indicting somebody, saying that you are guilty of this, we think you are guilty of this, right? An FIR is only another party having told the state that please take action against this person after registering an FIR so that you can investigate and take action. Right? So that's the state still has not yet made its mind up on whether somebody is accused or not. Right? So therefore, but we also have judgments that have said that the right against silence, right against self-incrimination and the right of silence also extends to the stage of investigation. So therefore, there is a little bit of lack of clarity in the law. We hope that the guidelines that the Supreme Court gives will make that clear. Another important aspect that we've not covered so far is the integrity of the seized material, right? Mm. Usually, because there have also been recent cases, allegations of evidence being planted by the state, right? It's possible because... I mean, nothing is impossible, right? You could have the best state. There could still be rogue actors within the state, right? And there are also pressures of, you know, trying to get convictions, all of that. There could be, if there is. And even in any case, the criminal justice system works in such a way that it is the state that needs to prove charges beyond reasonable doubt.
Prasanna is referring to several accusations made by independent security experts on the hacking and tampering of devices of those accused in the Bhima Koregaon case, in which many activists, academics and lawyers have been arrested.
So that is the case. They will need to establish that from the point of seizure onwards, both the custody, they knew exactly who had custody of these devices, for what length of time, right? And they know, they are able to know verifiably that no tampering happened from the time of seizure until it is presented in trial, right? The police will have to establish that. If they don't do certain common sense safeguards at the time of seizure, right? So earlier what used to happen, there used to be a seizure memo. So you get, there are three documents that are incriminating. You've taken those three documents at the seizure memo. You say this is now sealed. And you look at this, the seal is now put on this cover and these two witnesses have signed that it is sealed.
That's Panchnama,
right? So you have that process, but that doesn't work for electronic devices, right? You could put it inside the cover, I could still plant something wirelessly, right? So therefore it doesn't, so they you need to therefore evolve new guidelines as to how to do this. So one way to do this is the computation of hash values and providing hash value reports of all storage media in the devices that you seize.
Can you explain that?
So any storage media in your electronic device, right? So to your disks, your memory, flash memory, your thumb drive, whatever, right? Hard disk drive, flash drive, all of it. So the contents of all of that is put through a forensic hash computation tool, and the hash value report is given. At the time of trial, you do that computation again. If there is no tampering, no change in the contents, you will get the same hash value. If there is any change, you get a different hash value. So that's a simple computationally common sense approach to find out whether any particular storage medium, contents of any device, has either changed or not, has remained constant. If they rely on some incriminating material in the device, they will have to show that from the time of seizure and the time of presentation before the court in a trial, the contents of the device remained the same, and we found that this particular letter was there and this is incriminating. So that is why the integrity of electronic evidence is important. But there are no guidelines that now indicate that hash value reports will have to be given at the time of seizure. Usually what seems to be the practice is that the seizure happens and then with some time lapse, the devices are taken to a forensic facility and then hash value reports are generated. Even those generated, whether those reports are stored only by the forensic facility or by the police, there are no guidelines on it. Whether the accused can get a copy of it, when can they get a copy of it, how can they get a copy of it, no guidelines. Whether the accused or the accused counsel can remain present when such a cloning happens or when such extraction and hash value computation happens, no guidelines. Whether the police will have to counsel the accused that they have a right to be present when this kind of hash value computation and examination of the contents of the device happens, there is no guideline. So these are all the guidelines that we want, right? So in order to preserve the integrity of the electronic evidence, that you need to have all these common sense guidelines, you need to be able to counsel. So this is not new for our Supreme Court. There was no guidelines on the rights of an arrested person earlier. We had it in D.K. Basu, the 1980s, a celebrated judgment in D.K. Basu. The Supreme Court issued those guidelines, and thereafter, much later in 2009, many of those guidelines were incorporated as amendments in the CRPC. Similarly, in Dalita Kumari in 2013, the Supreme Court had to five judgments. The Supreme Court had to give guidelines on when to register an FIR. Right, that you have a right for an FIR, because it used to be a major problem. You go raise a complaint, the FIR doesn't get registered for years. So Lalita Kumari issued guidelines on when to lodge a preliminary inquiry, when to lodge an FIR, all of that. And similarly, much later, we have Justice Chandramouli Prasad's Arnish Kumar guidelines, which reiterated the position that was there in 41A of the CRPC. That's, for example, if you are accused of an offence that is for which you are punishable with less than 7 years, you will need to be issued a 41A notice, right? Because to say that arrest is an exception, no arrest is the norm. So long as you are cooperating with the investigation, you cannot be arrested for such offenses. That's the Arnish Kumar guidelines. And later, now in Antil's guidelines on when to give bail and anticipatory bail, surrender bail and the guidelines. So all of this, Supreme Court has given guidelines and reshaped our criminal procedure. It's not something new, and that seems something similar exercise is what we are looking to have the Supreme Court do even in this case.
The Union government in its reply to the PIL said that the Indian constitutional position with regard to search and seizure is naturally different from the constitutional position in other jurisdictions. And by this, they mean countries such as US and UK, which have developed some kind of law with regard to search and seizure of digital devices. In the US, Riley versus State of California is an important case where the court said that cell phones are not just phones, but are in fact mini computers, cameras, video players, Rolodexes, calendars, diaries, tape recorders, etc. The court insisted that there needs to be a warrant before search of such phones. And here I am quoting from this judgment. There is an element of pervasiveness that characterizes cell phones, but not physical records.
So, while we are thinking about what probably the Supreme Court can do, what are the laws, you mentioned that in the petition, what are the laws in the US and the UK in relation to seizure of digital devices?
Right. In fact, many of the, whether it is the PACE Act in the UK or the corresponding US Act and the holding in Riley, which is in many ways in 2013, a watershed moment holding the Riley versus State of California, the US Supreme Court decision that first recognized this difference. right? That there is the contents of a digital device is different, and any search or seizure in that will still need to answer the test of the unreasonable, the right against unreasonable search and seizure test, right? And the treatment of the devices as separate, it's not as a recognition that there is a lot much more information, and therefore you need to apply a stricter standard. All of this will need to be considered. But again, none of them, many of the issues that we discussed here, the BASE Act, for instance, specifically has protections against this. So when the Section 8 of the BASE Act in the UK, for example, when a search warrant is given, it needs a certification in writing that there is no legal privilege material that is seized. There is no part of the seized material has any excluded information, such as journalistic privilege. All of that is included in the BASE Act. So we need something similar. At least that is what we're hoping, that we'll get something similar here in the guidelines as well.
But in general, journalists don't have that much, I mean, in terms of privilege, I mean, I think it's on shaking grounds, right? I mean, that's how it has been.
Well, so it is, in fact, the early, very early judgment of the Supreme Court took the line that there is, even though there is no freedom of the press, we have the freedom of the speech. And that is the same freedom that is available whether you are a journalist or whether you are a citizen who is not a journalist. You have, your freedoms are at par, right? However, this understanding has evolved over time, right? In the 80s, in the Cricket Association of Bengal case, there was a recognition that modern democracy requires the press, and the institution of the press itself was fortified to show how they need to be both independent of the government as well as private influence. And the important role they play in a modern democracy, right? So therefore, these privileges that I talk about, journalistic privileges, source secrecy, all of that. So there is a certain constitutional recognition that has been evolved through our Supreme Court judgments. And that is also true across all modern democracies and all of the, we now have a very rich ECHR case law on the rights of the press, right? So where, and in general, also we now have the test of proportionality, we say in constitutional jurisprudence language, to say that any state action that infringes fundamental right will need to answer the test of proportionality. And one of the elements of the test of proportionality is for the state to justify that any rights restricting measure is necessary in a democratic society. And what is a democratic society? That the idea of democratic society includes a free press. Yeah.